And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Well, Dave, this is the run-up to July 4th. And I think this July 4th, the America that we're going to be celebrating, vastly different because of the Supreme Court in the last term than any America that I've lived in since I've been born. I think that the vast changes that they've made are yet to be fully felt and understood. Go beyond, way beyond the actual specifics of the cases that were the triggers. Because this is the spearhead of a 40, 50, 70-year movement to undo the New Deal. And to do it by changing the composition of the court and changing the meaning of the Constitution. And that came to fruition this just before this July 4th.
Yeah.
And I'd like to explore that a little bit and ask you what you think Americans can do about it, if they can do anything about it.
Well, you know, there's a lot to unpack there. You know, it's kind of interesting that we're sort of in between Juneteenth and July 4th. It looks like, you remember I always used to use the term regressives. It looks like we're regressing almost to antebellum times. Certainly, if not to Jim Crow times in America.
And seems to me Jim Crow times are too modern for this court. Don't they say, doesn't Clarence Thomas say that nothing is constitutional if you can't find an analogy in 18th and 19th century law?
Yeah. Like I said, back to antebellum times when slavery, you know.
You want to live in the 18th century?
Yeah. In his, his opinion or a concurring opinion this week, I kind of noticed that Roberts didn't let him write the opinions, but in his concurring opinion, which he doesn't have, you know, he doesn't have to do.
No, and he says he does it because he wants to point out the originalist view of this.
Right. And he's significant in the fact that he never mentions that the originalists were slaveholders.
Exactly.
You know, there's almost a rule with Thomas that it's always lose-lose for blacks. And he's a guy that admits, even in his opinion, he made reference to his one of the books he wrote about himself. He admits that he was a beneficiary of affirmative action. But he's one of these guys that someone gave him a ladder that he climbed up, and he's now pulled the ladder away from anybody else being able to do that. It's a particular type
isn't
of...
Isn't that the individualist approach? Me, me, me?
Yeah.
Not you, you, you? I'm all right, Jack.
Well, no, it's not you, you. It's us, us, us that he doesn't
He's not for us, us, us. He doesn't recognize us.
No, it is all individualism. But again, he got the benefit for him, but he doesn't think anybody else. He thinks it's bad for you. It reminds me of the people who think that, you know, we have this concept in America where you pull yourself on by your own bootstraps. It's, you know, we admire that kind of person, and we should make it hard for everybody because we can admire the people that pull themselves up through this, through the difficulties, and they forget about all the people that can't do it and all the suffering that's caused and all the failures that happen because of that, as if those failures are good for America, and they're not.
By the way, they're hypocritical about it, because if those people really believed it, they would applaud all the immigrants who come here, not because they're persecuted politically, but because they want a better life. But their attitude is those precisely the people who don't belong here.
Right.
And yet, that's the thing they claim to be upholding and extolling, people who act just that way, pulling themselves up by the bootstraps. These people are liars. They are purveyors of fake ideas they don't believe in.
Yeah. Well, there's the other side of the coin. You know, we just talked about I got mine, but you can't have yours. The other side of that coin is I never and this was in the case about forgiving student loans is I never got that, so no one else should get it. You know, we're picking winners and losers, and I've been picked as a loser type of thing. That the perfect has to be the enemy of the good type of thing.
But shouldn't you say, I mean, doesn't your mother raise you to say something analogous to, I never got that, how nice that you were able to get that?
Sure. Why should we make life harder for people? And that was, we're going to the New Deal. I mean, what Franklin Roosevelt wanted to do was make life better and easier for people, not harder. And the people opposed to him never see it that way. They thought life would be better for people if they struggled.
No, they didn't believe that. I don't think so. They believed that life would be better for them if they didn't have to pay the kind of taxes that were required to develop a welfare state. But don't forget, Franklin Roosevelt, the New Deal, created a welfare state, which didn't exist in the United States from Washington's time until FDR's time. You know, there were three great transformations in American life, right? The start of the country, the Civil War, and then the New Deal, which created the welfare state. The Civil War, which created the unitary nation. And these people don't want the welfare state.
And the question is, are we having a fourth or fifth transformation? You know, Reagan may have been somewhat of a fourth transformation to take us back, and certainly what's happened in the last several years, the last 4 or 5 years since Trump, they don't even quote Reagan anymore. They're even beyond Reagan in taking us back on these things.
Well, the Reagan counter-revolution and the movements that built on that, such as the Libertarian movement and then the MAGA movement, these can't long-term succeed. Just take a look at the question of affirmative action. The main beneficiaries of affirmative action are not Afro-Americans. It's women, more than half the population. Yeah. The strides that women have made in rights, in employment rights, in educational rights, in standing in society are all the direct result of the body of laws and business activities attendant upon affirmative action, on affirmative action.
Well, you get into this thing, though, with Ruth Ben-Ghiat talks about in her book about strongmen, is that this fascism or neo-fascism is misogynistic.
Yep.
And it's one of the key bases of this thing. And a lot of the Trumpers see themselves as men losing. You know, their masculinity is at stake. And Tucker Carlson plays on this all the time. It's why you have Putin, who plays on what Mussolini used to do, go bare-chested to show his masculinity. Now you got Robert Kennedy doing the same thing, Robert Kennedy Jr. doing the same thing. This surface masculinity, this cheap and easy masculinity rather than by achievement and openness and willingness to cooperate with other
people.
And
why is it masculinity? Why is brutality a good thing? And why should it be ascribed to men? Why shouldn't you ascribe brutality to hyenas? What's the big deal here?
Well, but this is where we're at. And you hit on it. Remember, I'm always, you know, besides talking about the regressives, I'm always talking about the four-pronged strategy from Lewis Powell. And the first one is to think long-term. And these folks have been working long-term to undo these, you know, the Warren Court type of thing. By the way, I think I've mentioned before, you know, for years, the Republicans attacked the court as being liberal and activist and whatever. And you got to point out that the last Democratic president to appoint a chief justice was Harry Truman in 1946. There hasn't been a Democratic chief justice since 1954. You know, we're going on
Warren
years.
Was a Republican.
Yeah, he was a Republican. He was the Republican vice presidential nominee.
Yeah,
he was a prosecutor.
Yeah,
these things. So we, you know, these myths that they create, but they're able to put these things together. They created these think tanks to come up with these bad ideas, and then they have these echo chambers that are really fantastic, and, you know, the repetition, and they're always attacking things. And, you know, and people buy into these things. They don't see the connection as to how all this was put together. I keep talking about this right-wing infrastructure that was put together and a lot of it being secretive.
And, by the way, there's a very local corollary here. The current leading element in regressive activity is a group called Moms for Liberty.
Yes.
Which is behind book burnings, book bannings,
sure,
making sure that American history isn't taught in the schools. They claim to be, you know, for parental rights. That is how they define parental rights. This is a movement created and financed by Leonard Leo.
Yeah.
Leonard Leo, who created and financed the Federalist Society, which is responsible for the way the courts are structured today.
Sure.
It's one group of people who've been doing this for a very long time and quite successfully and with big bucks.
It's been building an infrastructure, and they have these, you know, they have these names, Moms for Liberty and what have you. And
because I say it's local, because this weekend Moms for Liberty is having a convention in Philadelphia, and one of the features of the convention is a reception at the Hall of Liberty.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well,
and who's coming? DeSantis, Haley, that type.
Yeah, DeSantis, real liberty.
Yeah,
guy loving liberty. You know,
yeah.
The schools will teach what I tell them to teach, and nothing more.
And Moms for Liberty have chapters in of all 67 counties. They have chapters in 40 Pennsylvania counties.
Yeah, but again, with a lot of money from billionaire money.
That's right.
Leonard Leo is given $1.6 billion to do this.
That's right. For him to hand out a couple of hundred thousand is something he doesn't notice. But a group like this with a couple of hundred thousand can ruin the education and the life of plenty of millions of people in plenty of states.
A generation.
Yeah.
You know, I think we ought to take a look at, you know, the three or four cases that came down this week. There was only one that we can be thankful for. And that was the North Carolina case, where they rejected another one of these phony theories that came out of nowhere about the state, you know, the state legislature.
The independent legislature theory.
Right.
But they didn't reject it totally. They just rejected its most fully formed version. They still left the way open for some aspects of that theory to be implemented. I don't want to get into the details of it. In the main, they rejected it.
But basically,
and just so people know, what this theory says is no constitution matters. This is a nation of laws, but the supreme law doesn't matter. The legislature is not bound by the federal constitution or by the state constitution.
It's not subject to review.
And the courts, therefore, can't review it. So how did the legislature get formed? Where did it come from? Something had to create it.
Something happened. You know, and you notice Clarence Thomas was on the wrong side of that.
Naturally. Well. Maybe it's a Big Bang theory of the state legislature.
Yeah.
It just happened.
So, I mean, and there were a couple of cases that came down this term out of Alabama and Louisiana, so kind of surprisingly, where they said that their gerrymandering was so egregious and so racially targeted that they're going to have to redo those.
But don't forget, those were split decisions.
Yes, very split decisions.
Yeah.
And
there was horse trading. You could see there was horse trading involved there.
Yeah, and everything was tied together.
Yeah.
And you can bet these legislators, they don't really care. I mean, in Ohio last year, the state Supreme Court kept rejecting the map and ordering the legislature to do a fair map, and the legislature kept coming back with unfair maps.
Right.
And the Supreme Court never sanctioned them on that. So, and they had a conflict of interest because the governor's son sat on the Supreme Court, you know, and he passed and he approved the law. But, you know, and speaking of conflicts of interest, we had Alito, again, you know, being caught in another conflict or potential conflict of interest. And with these courts, there, you know, I have this ongoing discussion with the Scranton Times, which does not want popular elections of Supreme Court judges. They want appointments. And I'm somewhat more agnostic on it, but I say it doesn't matter which way you do it if you don't have good people doing the election or the appointing. I mean, the United States Supreme Court is appointed court, and you see what they're doing here. But we had that decision, and then we had, of course.
Well, why should you have lifetime appointments to any court?
Well, the idea was that they wouldn't have.
The idea was that they would they'd be above corruption.
But the
full thing was that they were supposed to be rich so that they could be above corruption. Okay, so now they don't have to be rich, but they have to be lifetime. But it's obviously not working.
Yeah. And of course, in those days, lifetime was they didn't live to be 80 and 90, you know, 85 and 90 years old.
Why do we have to, first of all, this Supreme Court to me is completely illegitimate. Completely illegitimate. Well, so why should they be there?
Well, let me just tell, because they are. Let me put it.
Because they are. Well, that's right.
But you know, you want to know what's happening. This is where elections have consequences. When the majority of the Supreme Court have five of them have been appointed by presidents who have lost the popular vote. Now the two by Bush were in his second W. Bush were in his second term. But it's still, if he wouldn't have had a second term, if he didn't have a first, then, of course, Trump lost the popular vote. So in that way, they're...
And don't forget that people do forget that he wouldn't have had the first if not for the Supreme Court saying he won Florida.
Right.
And the reason they were able to say he won Florida was because they told the Florida election officials, stop counting.
Yes. And that was the start, I think, of the illegitimacy, or at least... the major part of the illegitimacy argument on the Supreme Court, which said that our opinion is so bad that you can't use it for any other precedent.
Right.
On that. But again, it's a long-term struggle, and putting people in place where they can then be elevated to these things. There is also with Roberts a particular consistency. You know, in the case that struck down Title V of the Voting Rights Act, he said that we no longer had to be concerned about racism and election, you know, election rigging and things like that.
In the face of every academic study that shows that the United States is more segregated, in fact, today than before Brown.
And of course, immediately thereafter, all these Republican state legislators started passing laws that made it harder for people to vote.
Right.
And as if he was oblivious to this, and, you know, there's no, and continues to be oblivious to this. And then, of course, this week with his, with the decision on the affirmative action case, again, it's sort of we're oblivious to racism still existing.
They deny it exists.
Yeah, it's if we don't say it exists, it doesn't. It reminds me of the old case from the 19th century where they said that a tomato is a fruit and not a vegetable, and ignore what the botanists say.
Right.
It is what we say it is. Right. And you get to that phrase, you know, we're not final because we're infallible. We're infallible because we're final.
And I think it was Ketanji Brown that says saying that it's in law doesn't mean that it's in life.
Right. And that's what she brings to the court. You know, she unlike these, like the Roberts and the Alitos, who went through this entire bubble or silo of right wing organizations and positions. She was out there in the real world of things. And a lot of the appointees that Biden is getting through to the lower courts are the same way. You know, they there were very few public defenders, for instance, before Biden started appointing people. They're all prosecutors. And we can see what happens when you have folks who are just not, not qualified, like Judge Cannon down in Florida, and who make up laws and opinions, and even it becomes unpalatable to Trump appointees on the circuit court.
Well, so I don't think they're doing anything different than the Supreme Court reactionaries are doing, because they have a theory that says history counts. That's how you decide whether things are constitutional. And in case after case, they falsify the history. History doesn't count for them. They make it up.
Well, or they falsify facts, like they did in this this case about LGBTQ rights, about whether you could force somebody to make up a wedding invitation for you. You know,
a website.
You know, and the way they framed the case.
I wanted to ask you about that, because before you go further than that, I thought that in order to go to court, you had to demonstrate that you actually had something happen to you and you suffered. And the reason you're going to court is to overcome that disability, that suffering, right?
It's called an actual case in controversy.
An actual case. So here's a woman who sued, not because she does something and she was harmed by doing the thing, but because she thought she might do something. And if she decided to do something, that thing, somebody might come to her whom she didn't want to serve. And if that happened, she might violate the law.
That's
right?
Called an advisory.
None of it happened.
That's called an advisory opinion, which the Supreme Court has always said we don't give. Right. And also, it turns out that the people that were supposed to come to her may not have been.
They don't exist. They were made up.
Well, the one person, I think Michael, wasn't made up, but he wasn't the person who brought the case.
No, but they said that particular Michael did bring the case.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That particular Michael never heard of the case.
Yeah. And that should be the real outrage in this.
Yeah.
That should be the one that undermines it. I will tell you that
So why did they how did they get away with taking the case?
Because this court is results oriented. They want to take cases where they can do these things. It was like in the Citizens United, they decided it on a grounds that wasn't the original case.
In other words, they decided a different case.
Yeah, they decided a case about whether money was speech, when the original case was just whether you could prohibit speech during the last 2 weeks of an election period.
That's very interesting. We're not interested, but however interesting it is, but we're not interested. But here's what we are interested in, and this is what we'll decide.
Yeah, and people don't understand. This is nothing new. Cases have been picked and brought through the court previously, but it's now a very consistent pattern. On this, some of the civil rights cases were brought up carefully by Thurgood Marshall in that thing. And if you saw the movie about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, some of the cases about women's rights were there. There's a suspicion that the Dred Scott decision was politically drawn to supposedly help avert a civil war. It actually exacerbated it. James Buchanan's fingerprints are all over the background of that case.
Well, one way or the other, these are political decisions.
They are.
It's either the politics of one or the politics of the other, but they're political. There's nothing wrong with that. Law is politics. What's wrong is to deny it.
Yeah. And, of course, the politics that they choose and the way that they do this is, again, they don't really care about the harm they're doing.
I think they care. I think they want to do harm.
Well,
because they're wanting to harm a certain group of people, mainly the people who are not part of their group, not part of the ones who control the wealth and direct the politics of society.
Well, you know, in the affirmative action one, my observation has been that the principle, particularly for Clarence Thomas, is the blacks will always lose. You know, they lost before there was affirmative action because they were discriminated against. And now when there was affirmative action, They want to change the rules to say we shouldn't have race as a basis, so you're going to lose again. And of course, the thing in that case was really interesting. They never address the fact that you have legacy admissions to colleges, which favor white people. Employees of the
They favor wealthy white people, not just white
wealthy people. Employees, athletes. Although that may benefit in some ways African American students, but and then the other thing is right at the end, Roberts mentioned, I think in a footnote, something about we're not deciding this for the military. In the military,
exactly. That's very important, right?
Because the military, in fact, has been one of the most integrated areas of American society. It took a while, but the military could not function.
There's no logic to that, right? I mean,
no, there isn't. It says we're enunciating a principle, except in this
except instance, where it matters for us.
Except where the principle can't work.
Yeah.
You know, we admit that it can't work in terms of the military, but we're going to say it can work in terms of colleges and universities.
And don't forget, however much African Americans may have benefited from affirmative action, it is women as a group who were the main beneficiaries. The affirmative action approach is the approach that brought women closer to equal pay, closer to being able to get jobs across the board, and in general, it is women, white women, who are the main beneficiaries of the affirmative action movement.
Well, you know, you talk about women. Remember, Lilly Ledbetter lost her case in the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's the case for equal pay.
For equal pay, yeah. And then they have these cases where they say, well, the employees can't discuss among themselves what kind of salary they're getting.
Right.
You know,
but you know the one of the implications of this panoply of horrible decisions of the last 2 weeks is to see how it gets extended. It's not just what they decided that matters, is how that logic brings them to other things. For example, why should unions be legal? Why shouldn't we go back to the Lochner days when unions were considered antitrust violation? Get rid of unions. That's what they want to do. I think you can do it with the logic that they enunciated on affirmative action.
Yeah, wait and see. Just wait and see.
I don't want to wait and see. I want to make sure it doesn't happen.
Of course.
I don't think this court should exist. I don't think judges should have lifetime appointments. If you have to have this court having an 8-year term, just like you have a presidential 8-year term, then it has to be turned over. At least there'd be some chance that things would be reviewed.
Because the Constitution gives a lifetime appointment, but there's some bills that say, well, yeah, but it doesn't mean that you have to be able to decide cases. We're going to say that after X number of years, I think they've used 18, you become a circuit court judge. You sit on the circuit where you're from. You still get your lifetime appointment. You still get your pay. But you don't get to make laws for the whole country. You may get to make it.
We got to do something. This is a key political issue for the future, for now.
As we go into the Declaration of Independence.
So happy July 4th.
Happy July 4th. I have an op-ed coming out in the Scranton Times Tribune.
We'll read it. If we don't think it goes far enough, we're going to attack you.
Well, it's not quite on this, but read between the lines.
All right. See you next week.
See you next week.
You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week, same time, same place.